So it's called How to Be Amazing, and
as long as I don't have to claim to be amazing.
No, I make all claims of grandiosity on behalf of my guests.
Oh, that's very sweet of you.
Okay.
From PRX, it's How to Be Amazing. I'm Michael Ian Black. My guest today was once known as the Butcher of Broadway, which should be enough of an accomplishment for any man. But Frank Rich didn't stop at being the chief theater critic for the New York Times. Mid-career, he switched posts at the Times to become a popular op-ed columnist, authored several books, and then jumped to New York Magazine, where he currently writes about politics and culture.
I think every 15 years, I just change what I want to do.
In addition to everything else, Frank Rich not only writes about pop culture, he now creates it, serving as executive producer on the HBO comedy series Veep. Today on the program, I talk with Frank Rich about theater and politics, and he talks about working on a successful television show, something I know nothing about. Frank Rich, welcome to How to Be Amazing.
Thanks for having me.
So I want to start today with what is, I'm just going to say, unquestionably the best comedy on television, Veep. It is just hands down the funniest thing, probably of the last, I'm not going to put years on it, but it's really great.
Thank you.
And you are a sort of executive producer, consultant, guy who, all hands on deck guy. What do you do on Veep?
No one knows what any producer does, of course. That's the whole in fact, I was at some ridiculous like Hollywood award ceremony and a producer was getting a lifetime achievement award. And he said, the one thing I can say to every producer in this room is you're always asked the same question. What exactly does a producer do?
Well, it varies so much from project to project.
Exactly. My role in Veep is, I would say, kind of classic producing in the sense that I've been involved with it since it began as a few-page proposal written by Armando Iannucci, who created the show and is the showrunner. And then I'm a voice in the room about everything, you know, casting multiple drafts of every script, multiple cuts of every episode. And I spend many, many weeks in Baltimore, where much of the show is shot. And so it's everything from being there with 100-plus people on set.
Right, and Julie Louis like, Frank, grab me a Diet Coke. And you're like, absolutely, Mr.
Absolutely, absolutely. hanging out with the cast, the writers, is a large group of writers, all British. So that's basically my role. I love it. It's something I've never done before. But Veep is it's a very demanding, very exhilarating job.
For listeners who aren't familiar with Veep, it is the story of Vice President Selena – what is her name?
Selena Meyer.
Meyer, right, who is played by Julie Louis-Dreyfus and her sort of cast of bumbling eccentrics who populate her world and her professional world and some of her personal world. And we have a little clip just to give you a sample of the show.
We are in the ass of the hurricane now.
You may never meet her personally. She may never catch your eye or ever thank you. But Selena Meyer will never forget you.
You are going to change America in a way that usually only war and fluoride can.
She's going to ask you for a chamomile. She doesn't want chamomile. She wants peppermint. Okay, she gets a little confused, but do not point it out.
You guys are the chosen ones, all right? Not in a Jewish way either. In a, like, selected from a very short list of 10 way.
Some people say 3 microwaves is overkill. My response is always, tapas.
And never, ever, ever fuck up. End of induction. Clear?
So you get a...
You do get a sense.
Sample, a good sort of...
Yeah, that's from an episode where Selena is running for president. She's been the sitting vice president, and she's running for president. The president is stepping down. And you heard much of her central staff. The scene took place as sort of in a campaign headquarters and where they're telling underlings what to do. And it captures the mood of the show, I think, because it's really about bullshit. I mean, it gets, to my view, to the essence of Washington and politics, which is it's all about me and the rest of it. You know, we could care about the voters in any real way. It's a show where it's the un-West Wing. It's where truth, truth, justice, and the American way never triumph.
Right. There's that famous scene in The West Wing where President Bartlet's talking about the he's quoting Lincoln and he's saying, what is it, the truth of our better angels or something. And right. And Veep is the exact opposite.
Right.
All our worst angels.
It's all our worst angels. And, you know, I grew up in Washington as well as having covered it. And so I only found this when we started working together 3.5 years ago. So did Julia Louis-Dreyfus, grew up in Washington. And both of us left never to come back when we got out of high school and hold it in fairly complete contempt. And here come these Brits who are writing this show, I think partially because they are outsiders. They're not part of it and they're not sentimental about it. And so it really does capture, I think, what Washington sadly is, although hilariously, we hope in our case, too often like.
Yeah, it's I've seen more than one article saying, you know, sort of talking about different Washington insider shows like House of Cards and comparing House of Cards to Veep and saying, funnily enough, Veep is closer to the reality of Washington than something like House of Cards, which portrays Washingtonians as sort of, you know, evil and manipulative, but also very bright. And Veep, what I think is so great about it is it really captures the kind of raw humanity behind these sort of granite figures that we look at. When you think of, you know, the vice president, you think of somebody with a certain amount of gravitas, and Julie Louis-Dreyfus has zero gravitas. And,
yeah.
And I think it's what makes it so hilarious.
I think so, and I think it hits a certain truth. You know, growing up there as a kid, my family was not in politics, but I was around it. It's the company town. And even as a child, I remember being struck by the fact that school groups would come from all over the country and go to the Washington Monument and the White House and the Capitol, just as I did as a kid, Mount Vernon. But if you lived there, you came to think of them as sets and that the real Washington was something else entirely. That was the Disneyland version of Washington, whereas the real Washington could be farcical. It also could be horrible because it was essentially, when I was growing up, a de facto segregated city with a lot of African Americans living in poverty, even in alleys, none of which school groups visiting from, you know, Minnesota would see. But I do think that people, you know, even House of Cards romanticizes Washington a little bit. Power does achieve things, I think, in that show, whereas in Veep, it really is more like the dysfunction we're seeing, particularly today.
You grew up sort of surrounded by that industry town. You left saying, I'm never going to come back. And yet now you spend a good part of your working life writing about it. And how did that happen?
I'm fascinated by it. I was always interested in politics. I was born in Montgomery County and lived there until I was about 9, but then at the height of white flight, my family moved into Washington. So I actually grew up in the city and from 5th grade through high school graduation, went to public schools.
Well, why? Why did they move in when everybody else was moving out?
Because it was cheap.
Yep. Best reason of all.
My stepfather was a lawyer with an office 17th and K Street, and it was easy to get to the office. And we moved into a neighborhood, Cleveland Park, near the Washington Cathedral, which is now and has been for a number of years a very costly upper middle class neighborhood. But then there was nobody there. Indeed, there was, because whites were fleeing when we moved in on my block off of Reno Road, like a third of the houses were empty. When I went into fifth grade, there were not enough students in the public school system in the neighborhood to fill the fifth grade. So they had to combine fifth and sixth grades. And while the schools were technically integrated, they weren't really. So what that meant was there were so few white people. And I got, you know, it's a company town. I got really, really interested in it. Also, when I was about 11, Kennedy started running for president, and that was a palpable change in Washington. I mean, even I could see was this young guy bringing this energy. And so, of course, I'm interested in politics and American history. And at the same time, I was a theater nut and television nut and grew up first television generation. So those things always sort of coexisted. I'm a little bit, journalistically, I'm a little bit tired about Washington. I've tried to write less about it. in recent years and sometimes succeed. I'm fascinated by the rise of this new right. I think, you know, I think someone like Rand Paul is much more interesting to write about than, say, Hillary Clinton.
Right.
But I found also Obama, at least at the beginning, I'm not judging him as a president, but I found it was such an exciting thing when he was running and taking over Washington after the Bush years. That was an exciting transition. But now it's like, you know, if you think, I don't think this is necessarily going to happen, but what if it is a Hillary Clinton, Jeb Bush race? Mm-hmm. It may well not be, but still it's sort of, you know, there are other things I'd like to write about as well, cultural things and things a little bit, historical things a little bit off of this gridlocked, polarized mess we have.
Well, speaking of which, you said, you know, growing up in what sounds like a basically all-black school and—
No, so, I was in a school that was the last almost all-white school.
Oh, okay.
But it did have black students and it did, we can talk about it if you want, but it did come to sort of a crisis while I was there and I got involved in controversies involving race. Washington was, you know, it was a tinderbox,
yeah.
and it was inevitable what happened as it happened in other cities. It was so fraught that we didn't study Huckleberry Finn because they thought in English class because they thought it would stir up people too much. It was ridiculous. In retrospect, I had an American history course where the teacher skipped over the Civil War.
What?
We just went, you know, and the schools were they were also, by the way, while I was in them, not only did they have no money, but the National Education Association declared the Washington public school system the worst school system.
Unbelievable.
And no, we went right from the Louisiana Purchase to the Spanish-American War. And I remember my 11th grade American—
There were slaves and there weren't. Anyway,
Well, the thing is, I mean, I still remember Miss Gillespie, our 11th grade American history teacher, was a Southern white woman, and she asked us to write—she asked the students, not me in particular— to write Congress to get the national anthem changed to Dixie.
Oh my God.
I remember her saying, you know, that Star Spangled Banner, no one can sing it. Dixie, you just can't help but join in. So it was really, it was insane, but it was great training for me in the absurdity of politics and getting interested in it and caring about it, even though Washington itself, I never really wanted to be a part of again.
So you bundled yourself off to Harvard.
Yep.
And you said you were the editor of the student paper in high school. Then you went off to edit the Crimson.
I edited the editorial page, and which was fascinating because it was the height of the Vietnam War by that point, and Harvard was exploding. Every place I went was exploding. I also started writing theater and film reviews, and—
And you had an unbelievable experience when you were writing this theater review of a new Stephen Sondheim musical that passed through town.
Yes, I had. In retrospect, I was very lucky. I had two weird unexpected experiences that basically shaped my career. One was, indeed, in the days when Broadway musicals routinely tried out in places like Boston, Washington, a musical called Follies. Which is now considered a classic by Stephen Sondheim, but then was just a new show on its way, previewing in Boston on its way to New York, opened in Boston. I reviewed it for the Harvard Crimson, you know, in my little Mickey Mouse collegiate way. And I loved the show.
In that Mickey Mouse Harvard way.
That Mickey Mouse Harvard way, yes. And, it's a very— A lot of things about Harvard I could live without. But anyway, it's kind of something of a pretentious place. But I reviewed this, and of course, it's like pissing in the wind. You don't expect anyone to read it except maybe friends in your dorm. And then in those days of mail, I got a letter at the Crimson from Stephen Sondheim, who'd written the score. The music and lyrics.
Was this his first time of writing both score and lyrics?
No, it was his fourth because the first show he did it for I saw in its tryout in Washington when I was a kid, which was a funny thing happened way at the Forum. Then there was a failure called Anyone Can Whistle, which I never saw in 1964. Then the year before, when I was at Harvard, I had reviewed Company, which also had tried out in Boston. Follies got lousy reviews in Boston. I liked it. And so he wrote me this letter that I still have saying, I think you really understood the show, which was, of course, very flattering to me as a kid. And he said, I'd like to meet you if you care to. So, yeah, yes, of course. No, I don't want to meet you. So I had a drink with him at, I remember, the Statler Hotel in downtown Boston. And that was essentially it. We had a little bit of a correspondence for a bit. Would not get to know him for many, many years until really after I stopped being a theater critic, which was 20 years ago. But what was significant about that to me as a person was he made me feel – he gave me confidence. He made me feel maybe I know something. Maybe I'm not just some, you know, asinine, know-it-all kid just saying stuff that was, you know, masturbatory. Maybe I actually knew something about what I was seeing on stage. And the confidence that gave me as a writer and I think that'd be true of anyone in that situation, was enormous. I didn't, in fact, even become a drama critic for another 7 years. I my career went in another direction, which if you want to hear another story about it, that's similarly weird, I can tell you.
Please.
About. The other thing that happened that was sheer luck, as the Vietnam War was heating up and the Cambodian incursion was happening and Harvard was shut down by strikes and protests, and it was a very scary, interesting, depressing time, and I was involved as a student journalist in covering it. There was a guy who was a teaching fellow at MIT down the way in Cambridge who had been a Crimson editor, he told us, in the 1950s, now was, you know, in his early middle age, and would come by the Crimson almost weirdly, given the age difference, to hang out with these kids who are 20.
Not almost, straight up weirdly.
Straight up weirdly. now, part of it we realized was he was looking to buy some dope. And he claimed to have spent time in Vietnam working for the Defense Department and the RAND Corporation and to have worked for McNamara and Kissinger, know all these people. And he was a huge—
And did you believe him?
At first we thought— What? Or he's self-aggrandizing. We'd never heard of him. He wasn't famous or anything. But he would tell us lengthy stories about sort of the councils of war that were fascinating to us, if they were true. We didn't know. And there was something about him that was kind of charismatic. And the week I graduated, on graduation week on Sunday, that morning— We got the Sunday New York Times. My roommates and I got the Sunday New York Times delivered. And there's a front page story about what was now known as the Pentagon Papers. Secret history of the Vietnam War that the Times has obtained. And we start reading it and we recognize all the stories. They were all things this guy had told us. And his name was Dan Ellsberg.
Wow.
And we said, well, he must be legitimate, and he must be the source, because the source was not known.
Right.
Would not be known for weeks. And so I went to class day, and I went to in Harvard Square. Then and now there was a newsstand. I was at the time smoking cigarettes. I went to buy some cigarettes, and I see Ellsberg with like 7 copies of the Sunday New York Times, and he gives me this kind of impish grin, like, ah, caught. And I said, aha, you know, or whatever I said. And I had the president of mine, I said, well, I want to write about this. I want to talk to you. He says, well, I'm going underground. I'm disappearing, because he's completely secret. His source, he wouldn't be named as a source for another 5 or 6 weeks, as I recall. And he said, but you can find me through my lawyer. He gave me the name of his lawyer, who was a famous left-wing lawyer at the time, Leonard Boudin. And it led to me, as I was graduating, that summer of graduation, selling a piece, my first real professional piece, to Esquire, a profile of him. And I was calling, speaking to him in phone booths. He was undergrad. I think he was fleeing the FBI. Ultimately, the FBI tapped my parents' phone. They came after me a bit. But it was, of course, a great experience, and I wrote a 10,000-word piece, so it sort of started my political writing career.
Welcome back to How to Be Amazing. During his career as a writer, Frank Rich has tackled politics, pop culture, and of course, theater. In fact, during his years as chief theater critic at the New York Times, he earned the moniker the Butcher of Broadway for seemingly being able to single-handedly close a show with a bad review. Coming up, we talk about his years as a writer, and I throw out my idea for an AIDS musical on roller skates. You loved theater from such an early age. You attended theater. You obviously got to know Sondheim a little bit. Why did you end up writing about theater instead of writing for the theater?
I've asked myself that. As a kid growing up interested in the theater, I was always – I went through phases of being interested in every part of it. Acting, playwriting, direct – I mean, in a student kind of way.
Were you a good actor?
Not particularly. And I knew enough to know I wasn't. I loved writing prose, and I loved, journal. I liked fiction, and I liked journalism. I liked, reading In Cold Blood and Serialization and The New Yorker. I liked reading reviews. I liked reading political commentary and political reporting. And so I never really seriously considered going into show business. And there were other factors. For instance, there wasn't much of a drama club at my high school because they couldn't afford to heat the building after.
Yeah, you can't afford composition paper. You're not gonna elaborate costumes.
Yeah, I did what little there was. And then when I got to Harvard, I went and tried out for the Crimson for the paper and never looked back. But a huge influence on me, which also makes it weird in some ways I didn't go into it, was that because I loved the theater in particular so much, and because Washington was a huge tryout town in those days for Broadway shows, where every 2 weeks a major play on its way to Broadway would pass through Washington. I bought so much standing room and hung around the theater so much that the manager took pity on me and gave me a job as a ticket taker so I could go for free.
Oh, wow.
And it was an incredibly formative experience as a writer and everything else, because plays would come in, they'd be good, bad, or indifferent, and you'd see standing in the back, I was a kid, they didn't notice me, them putting in changes every night.
Right.
And you'd see, I still remember The Odd Couple, Triana Washington, when it was a new play, and Mike Nichols and Neil Simon, whom I didn't know, working on it, changing jokes, switching things around, taking the Pigeon Sisters in and out of the second act from day to day.
Those poor Pigeon Sisters.
Those poor Pigeon Sisters. So I did that, and it was a great period for Broadway, too. So the artists were high stature for the most part, Peter Brook and Jerome Robbins. And so that I loved the excitement of that, but I don't know. I also loved learning about writing, and having now worked on Veep for 3.5 years, which is sort of like being in the theater, I wish I had actually done it earlier.
In what way is working on Veep like being in the theater?
Because you're with a company of actors that's a very tight ensemble, with writers. There's a big in our show, because HBO will underwrite, there's a huge rehearsal process.
And that's unusual. I mean,
it's very unusual. Actors in our show who work on network series from time to time, Matt Walsh, who plays Mike McClintock, the press secretary, who's a UCB guy and a long career in television and movies, he'll say, often what happens is you turn up, if you're guesting on a sitcom, network sitcom, you've learned your sides. You'll say, oh, he's angry in this scene. You hit your mark and you do it and you leave. Armando Iannucci, who created Veep, his process, and this dates back to his earlier work in doing comedy for the BBC, mainly in England, is scripts are written in some kind of, early form. Actors start to learn them. But then what he does and what HBO will pay for weeks before we shoot, often, will be in a conference room, sitting around the table, have a table read. Then he'll say, pretend that the door is over there and the desk is over there. Get up, get on your feet, carry your scripts. If you want to add lines, do. Because so many people, including Julia, come from an improv background, either Groundlings or UCB or Second City, Saturday Night Live, they come up sometimes with some funny stuff. Veep is not improvised. It is entirely scripted. But during that rehearsal process, the writers sit around the room and take notes, and they cannibalize the best stuff, and they keep regenerating the scripts. It's like a spin and dry cycle, very time-consuming, but tremendous fun. So you feel like you're with a theater company rehearsing a play or trying out a play out of town and keep working on it, and things move in and out right to the very last minute. And, of course, that continues in the editing room because we tend to overshoot our episodes. And so it's this evolving thing. So it reminds me, in a way, of when I was a ticket taker as a 15-year-old. Only now, instead of standing on the outside looking in, I'm a part of it, and it's in the rehearsal room when it's going on, and it's a complete blast.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
Getting back to the your career as a theater critic, and this might be a dumb question, but what is the job of a critic? I mean, what is a critic's mission statement?
To me, the only reason to be a critic, and it's the only reason I became a critic, is to get people excited enough to go to the theater and get them excited to go to things that might be difficult, that might not be commercial, as we say, or well promoted, to explain why there's a good reason to go and why you might actually enjoy it and get something out of it. And indeed, the first reviews I wrote were in high school because I'd seen, you know, in a culture where everyone was watching television, and particularly Washington, no one went to the theater. I mean, very few of my peers
still
did.
Don't, right?
Still don't.
Yeah.
And yeah, that hasn't changed really. It was certainly true at college. But I get so excited. I had to write about it. It's like news in a way, news from the cultural front. And so that's the real point. And when I was a kid and reading critics, the critics I liked were those who made me feel, through the quality of their writing and the vividness of their writing, what it was like to be at that opening night. To read Walter Kerr, who then wrote for the Herald Tribune, or to read Ken Tynan, who was writing for the New Yorker, oh my God, this was what it was like to watch the opening night of Ethel Merman and Gypsy, or this huge bomb,
right,
where everything went wrong, and that to me was the fun of reviewing.
But I'm guessing you don't get the honorific, the Butcher of Broadway, by cheerleading shows constantly.
Yeah, well, the thing is, it's less true now. But in I was the tail end of the era when the New York Times critic, no matter who it was, it could have been a talking dog, was thought to control the fate of Broadway shows. And, you know, a rave would turn something into a hit and a pan would kill something. That belief was founded on a little bit of reality because the number of newspapers in New York had dwindled. There had been 7 when I was growing up. There were basically 3 at the time I was drama critic. And the Times had more clout than the other two for a very simple reason. It had the most theater coverage.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, it was wildly overstated. Merchandising of theater had changed dramatically to counteract a bad review in the Times or anywhere else. They were clever at turning things into hits that got bad reviews. I mean, I didn't like Andrew Lloyd Webber's Starlight Express. I hated it, in fact. But it ran longer than West Side Story. You know, you could sell it.
The now classic Starlight Express.
Yes, exactly.
And that was the one on roller skates, right?
That was the one on roller skates.
The first of many roller skating musicals.
It's true, actually. At the same time, shows that were not commercial, I couldn't turn into hits.
Like what? I mean, what were you championing?
Sunday in the Park with George is a classic.
Was that not a hit?
It was not a hit. It won the Pulitzer Prize. It ran, I'm guessing, 15 or 16 months. It did not win the Tony. It lost most of its investment. It never toured. It's now regarded as a classic. In fact, as Steve Sondheim will be the first to tell you, almost all of his shows lost money. And indeed, when I collected my theater reviews after I was done in a book called Hot Seat, I just listed at the back the shows that I had praised the skies that flopped and the shows that I couldn't stand.
Right.
You know, Phantom of the Opera. I'm very lukewarm about it. Does anyone even remember I reviewed it? I don't think so. I luckily barely do at this point.
Oh, no, I saved that review. It's hanging on my wall. You moved over from theater into opinion writing in the political realm, I guess. How did that transition happen? And were your bosses at the Times kind of like, what? What are you doing?
It was their idea. It never occurred to me, quite honestly. What happened was in 1991, I started being drama critic in 1980. 1991, a couple of things happened that sort of were life-changing. One was I got married for a second time to someone I'm still married to, very happily married. Also, a month after our wedding, without belaboring it, my mother was killed in a car crash at a fairly young age. She was younger than I am now. And I was very close to my mother, and she had done a lot to inculcate me and my interest in arts and theater, taking me to theater. And it was a complete shock because it was such a sudden death. And I wanted, and I just felt something snapping me. I didn't want to review the theater anymore. And I went into the Joe Lelyveld, who was then the managing editor of the paper, and I said, I really want to quit. And he wisely and nicely said, you're not in any condition to make a decision. Take time off. This happened in basically in July of 91. See how you feel in the fall. Just stop doing it. You know, take care of your family and so on. And so I did. Also, it was a terrible time for the theater, much worse than it is now. But people always say the theater's in terrible shape. It was really in bad shape. Many theaters were dark. Companies were struggling. It was before Disney came in and sort of pumped money into Broadway. 42nd Street hadn't been redone yet. And I also felt I had run out of things to say. You know, I felt if I'd reviewed five David Mamet plays or five August Wilson plays, what do you have to say about the six, except it's a little better or worse than the last one? And so I said I'm leaving at the end of the season, and I thought, well, I'll go write books. And there was a book I wanted to write and ultimately would write, and I would leave the paper and maybe freelance. Joe and Hal Raines, who was in the editorial page editor, came up with this idea of me doing an opinion column, which is something I never aspired to. And I think where it came from was, as a sideline, I'd started writing pieces, particularly then for the New Republic, that sort of combined culture and politics in the news. And I think they saw something in that that I didn't see. Also, because a lot of the last years of my theater viewing coincided with the AIDS crisis, which, on top of everything else, killed off a ton of people in the theater in particular. And it was a subject of my writing because it was the period of the Normal Heart and AIDS plays and all of that. That had sort of entered my writing.
Once it got to AIDS plays on roller skates, then I really feel
then,
like
no, then it was bad. And musical AIDS, AIDS musicals on roller skates. And so that's basically what happened. I thought, do I really want to do it? And I did it. And I can't say that I wildly enjoyed it. I really didn't like writing the column at the beginning. I don't think I was particularly good at it. And a few years in, I tried to leave it, and they came up with the idea of giving me a longer column,
mm-hmm.
and which had never been tried before, and I liked that better. But I still was unhappy, and they were very accommodating. They gave me a deal where I wrote a longer column every 2 weeks and then wrote pieces for the magazine, and then I got antsy again and finally left it. And I, you know, so writing a column, I like some of it, but I'm proud of some of the work I did, particularly during the run-up to the Iraq War, and that led to me writing a book about that. But I also overdosed on that. I think every 15 years,
mm-hmm.
I just change what I want to do because I did that just slightly longer than I had been theater critic.
what did you feel like you really got wrong as an opinion writer, and what did you really get right?
Well, I definitely got right. I definitely got the Iraq War right. And I don't mean just about my opinion about the Iraq War. I feel the opinion, whether in reviewing or in political opinion writing, it's the least interesting thing. It's sort of the perceptions you can bring to it. And somehow, maybe it was my theater background, I immediately knew intrinsically, without being particularly an expert on Iraq, that it was all bullshit, that the whole case for the war was showmanship and bullshit. And it was just obvious to me. And you know, it was interesting. Paul Krugman, my former colleague, also I don't think really particularly wrote about or even cared about foreign policy, but he figured – he's an economist, and he figured out it was fraudulent from the point of view of numbers. Hmm. I figured – that's how he came to his realization that everything was bogus. In my case, it was – so it wasn't so much ideology. In my case, it wasn't ideology either. I mean, I was in favor of us going to war in Afghanistan to strike the Taliban after 9/11. But it was just a sense that this is fake. I could just tell it was fake. I just – in my gut. Where I failed as an opinion writer is – and I sort of wrote this when I left the job – I wrote about a lot of things in retrospect. I felt I had to have an opinion about them, and I did. And, you know, they were probably not particularly interesting opinions just because there's a lot of times when nothing much is happening. Mm-hmm. And so I, you know, those obligatory pieces, whatever the – there's many cases are completely forgettable controversies that mean nothing to history now. The Clinton era, a lot of the Clinton era before the war in Iraq, obviously before Bush, I just I feel like you're spinning wheels. And I have to say, I think every columnist goes through some version of this, and you can feel it as a reader.
I wanted to, as we round home, I wanted to talk a little bit more about Veep and the kind of joyful profanity that exists in Veep and your history with talking about this issue. You had written a column Congress was trying to censor HBO at one point regarding Deadwood, and you wrote a kind of impassioned and profane column about that. Talk a little bit about that and the kind of and what profanity brings to shows like Deadwood and Veep. And before we do, we actually have a very funny clip of profanity being used in Veep.
Did your boyfriend know anything about this?
I was trying to use Jonah for intelligence.
That's like trying to use a croissant as a fucking dildo.
I thought
that... No. Let me be more clear. It doesn't do the job, and it makes a fucking mess. Get out of my office.
Do you know who came up with that analogy? Because somebody deserves an award just for that analogy.
It was probably Armando, although, you know, he has this group of writers. Well, here's how it happened. This is Armando's style. I mean, I'm – long before I knew Armando, indeed, when I was writing about Deadwood, long before I was involved with HBO, I'm for complete freedom of speech in everything, including in culture and pop culture. I think it's, you know, it's a color to play with if you're creating something. But Armando was famous for a series on British television called The Thick of It. That was – people say Veep's a remake of it. It isn't. Veep's different, but they're cousins of each other. And incredibly profane and foul-mouthed. And the show was an enormous hit and could be shown that way on British television. Mm-hmm.
I think we should use the carrot and stick approach, yeah. You take a carrot, you stick it up his fucking ass, followed by the stick, followed by an even bigger, rougher carrot.
He also, which brought him to my attention and started my campaign to get him to HBO, he did a movie that had some of the same called In the Loop.
Oh, yeah.
About the run-up to the Iraq War, in fact, feature.
Which, as an aside, I would highly recommend.
It's a great movie, and... it gave me the idea of HBO going after him to bring him on. HBO had been looking for a smart show about Washington. They'd done a show before I got there called K Street that was done by Steven Soderbergh and George Clooney. Didn't work. They tried some other things. I saw In the Loop and I said, this is the guy. Well, it turned out the thick of it, his BBC show, had been, unbeknownst to me, several years earlier, been the subject of a bidding war by American networks that wanted to buy it and adapt it, one of which was HBO. Armando had no control over it. It was owned by the BBC, and the BBC sold it to the highest bidder, which was ABC. So HBO didn't get it.
They owned by the Disney company.
Right. Exactly.
Can't
see. And so this was the thick of it, and I never saw that a pilot was made. But it was done with a director who would seem right for Armando's sensibility, Christopher Guest. But it was a terrible experience for Armando. He's talked about it publicly. The show was completely censored, not just the language, everything about it. He was barely allowed on the set. By his account, there were like 20 suits dictating everything that would be inoffensive. And so he had vowed he never would work on American television again. But gradually we got over that, and he came up with the idea for Veep. There was never any discussion about the profanity. We knew what we were getting, and this language. What's great about the profanity in Veep is it's clever. They keep coming up on new variations, and they're just masters of it. And of course, here Julia, sort of America's sweetheart. From Seinfeld speaking this way, people just can't get enough of it. And by the way, she fucking loves it. and she's great at it. I don't think it's the only terrific thing about the show, but I'm very, I'm very proud that we have a fuckload, as they would say on Veep, of profanity. But it's not something where people think, we're going to put it in a musical number.
Right.
It's a natural part of the writing process, and no one thinks twice about it.
You wrote a long column about conservative comedians for New York Magazine recently, and kind of, I don't know, you were quite making the case that they can't exist, but that they don't exist. Why do you think they don't exist?
A lot of them do have some of them do have some skill. And I'm not sure I have an answer. I asked a lot of people. I think part of it is that there's more anger. Now, anger is a huge part of comedy, and it's a part of liberal comedy too. But to take anger and transform it into comedy is a creative process that takes talent and work, as you well know. And
just for the record, Frank Rich just called me a genius comedian.
Exactly. Exclamation point. and a lot of them are so – they just don't get past the anger. Mm. And part of it is sort of Obama derangement syndrome. And by the way, there's a lot of liberal comedy about Bush that was not funny or was just angry too. But it just is not producing – a lot of stuff that's funny. And also another problem is that the politics of the right are essentially pro-establishment. And it does sort of side with this is an unfair generality, but it does side with the ruling class. It does side with
right.
The corporate class. And so it's not taking up the underdog.
Right.
And of course, a lot of great comedy is apolitical. There, someone like Dennis Miller is very interesting, very smart guy, but he's really caught up in politics now. People have talked, he hasn't entertained it, but talked about him running for office in California. He appears at political events. Once you do that, you've sort of lost your creative independence. In the same way, there's nothing funny about Al Franken now, and I would argue even in the tail end of his comedic days when he was on Air America, the more he became involved in liberal politics, actually became in politics, the less he became a comedian.
Yeah, he became kind of strident and stone-faced. I mean, his Eric America show really wasn't it seems like it wasn't even meant to be funny.
It wasn't, but the extent that I remember it, there were jokes on it. It just wasn't, which is fine. People are entitled to change. Look at someone.
I disagree.
I've changed my profession, but you almost feel like Miller should go into politics. What I find completely unconvincing, however, is the case made by conservative comics who haven't made it, that it's because of a blacklist in Hollywood because they're conservative, because it just isn't true. Rupert Murdoch owns Fox. Mm-hmm. I'm not talking about Fox News. I'm talking about the Fox Network, FX. If he thought, that there were right-wing comics that were funny enough to draw an audience in a country with a lot of conservatives watch television, as he knows better than anyone, he put them on the air in a fucking second. Yeah, and particularly if you're conservative, you've got to believe the market is good for something. You know, and so that Rupert Murdoch will put on Fox a show created by conservatives like 24, mm-hmm. or one created by liberals like Glee, is all about the marketplace. And there are plenty of conservatives working in television, the movie industry, and everything else. This blacklist thing is a joke, and it's an excuse for failure. And if you build a better mousetrap, show business is it's the most ruthless market. If Hitler could do great come back and do great stand up, someone would give him a late night show and a band and the whole thing.
I'd pay to see it.
Yeah, I would too.
All right. Well, Frank Rich, before I let you go, there's one thing that we do at the end of each episode of How to Be Amazing, which is called The Amazing Five, in which I'm going to throw five sort of categories at you, and I'd like you to offer our listeners a recommendation in each of these categories. Number one, movie.
Well, like anyone who's seen it, I'm just... Smurfs 2. No. Right now, Boyhood.
Oh, yeah.
Sort of Linklater movie is just incredible. Movies in general, I mean, I'm omnivorous, you know. Hitchcock, Truffaut, Robert Altman.
Great.
You know, Woody Allen. I mean, there's so many people I admire. But of recent movies, I would have to put Boyhood in a special category.
Books. What are you reading that you love right now?
I just read a book by a political historian named Rick Perlstein. And Perlstein, as far as I can tell, he writes The Nation. He's a liberal. But he writes history that's not informed by ideology at all, and even conservatives raved about it. And this one, The Invisible Bridge, is essentially just set in 3 years. It begins with the Watergate hearings, and it ends in 76 before the election. It just ends at the Republican convention when Gerald Ford is narrowly nominated by his party over Reagan, who came within 100-odd delegates of beating him. The way that this is a mammoth book, The Invisible Bridge, the way Perlstein does it, you feel it's like a Rosetta Stone to everything that's happening in American politics right
now.
I love Robert Caro's Johnson books. A lot of things about them are different, but what they have in common is they mean to be definitive histories of the era. And Caro's Johnson books are basically about the rise and fall of the last truly successful liberal New Deal, Great Society president. And Rick Perlstein's three books to date are the counter-narrative. They're about the rise of the right in reaction to it. So together, it's just a juicy compendium of American history.
I'd love to see you write the definitive history of Starlight Express.
Well, I don't know if I can aspire that. but I also read a lot of fiction. You know, I love Dickens. I reread Dickens all the time. Graham Greene. You know, I've
never heard of either of those.
Yes.
Food.
I guess I'm the typical New York Jew. Can never get enough really spicy Szechuan or otherwise food. But I sort of like almost everything. So,
music. What are you listening to?
I'm a big jazz nut.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I do listen to contemporary music, and of course, I listen to the rock music of my generation, and theater. You know, I've always liked theater music, obviously. But
what contemporary jazz musicians do you love? Because I don't think I can name one, except maybe Brad Mehldau.
Well, actually, Brad Meldow is a perfect example. You know, contemporary jazz musicians, not so many. He's great, by the way, and I loved Charlie Hayden, who just died. Mm-hmm. But I love bebop. I mean, I really like I love the modern jazz classics. You know, I'm a crazy for, you know, Miles and Charlie Parker and Monk and
say Dizzy Gillespie, just because I like to hear the words Dizzy Gillespie.
Well, Dizzy Gillespie, absolutely. When I'm writing, I find I can sort of write if there's no words to music. Mm-hmm. So I'll listen, you know, like everyone else, I'll take a streaming app and right. listen to
the Dizzy Gillespie station.
Dizzy Gillespie, you know.
All right, last one, grab bag. Anything that needs a shout out, some sort of gadget, some sort of article of clothing, a museum, anything.
I'm just trying to think if there's something I could say that's not...
incredibly racist.
Incredibly racist. incredibly obvious. I'll tell you, you know, in a civic sense, I'm a big fan of wherever you are. If there's a local historical museum, like it'd be the Museum of the City of New York mm-hmm. here. My mother used to take me as a kid to the Phillips Collection in Washington, which has expanded in recent years, but then was just in, and it's still part of it, what we'd call a brownstone near, sort of vaguely near DuPont Circle. And it had Paul Klee paintings. It had some wonderful Renoirs. It had some modern art. It was this hodgepodge created by this wealthy family called Phillips. But the small museum in any city is always worth checking out, and people forget about that.
Right.
The Cooper Hewitt, I always loved in New York. It's about to reopen in a new configuration. We'll see. Which is not to say you shouldn't be going to, you know, the Met. You know, just one great thing after another in this city, at least.
Well, Frank Rich, thank you so much. You were amazing today. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
I don't know about that, but I really enjoyed talking.
I know about it. You were amazing. Thank you.
It's great talking with you. Thanks.
How to Be Amazing is brought to you by PRX. To hear more stories, visit prx.org. Like How to Be Amazing on Facebook, and please follow us on Twitter. And check out our website at howtobeamazingshow.com. Today's show is mixed and edited by Kristen Clark, with music composed by Chad Crouch. I'm Michael Ian Black.